You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
It is Wednesday, March 11th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program tonight, tough night for Sanders. Biden has a big night, but now may face his biggest challenge, a debate. Two-person debate coming up this Sunday, then followed by Arizona, Florida, Illinois, Ohio, still 577 delegates on the table that day. Little consolation, but exit polls show the majority of voters not voting on issues, and that in 20 states in a row, Medicare for All was favored bigly. Wash your hands, folks. COVID-19 continues despite Donald Trump's wishing it away. Appeals court orders the DOJ to give Congress the unredacted Mueller report. Senator Murphy from Connecticut requests an investigation into the political weaponization of federal agencies against, you got it, the Bidens. Democrats engage in the fight as Trump wants to bail out shale producers. Matt Gaetz quarantines himself in a Walmart parking lot, and Trump buries Jeff Sessions in a Georgian primary. Alabama. Whatever. I'm tired. St. Paul teachers go on strike. All this and more on today's program. Yes, Alabama. Of course. Alabama. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. I am a little bit tired. Obviously, we were here till about what was it? 11 last night and change. And then I head over to MSNBC to do the graveyard shift when they let anybody who is not wearing a Joe Biden T-shirt on.
Or implicated in the covering up of war crimes over the last several years. It's like, hi, I did PR for Abu Ghraib and I'm appalled by Donald
right,
Trump.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
Do they have a special door they make you go in through the back?
No, but I do have a pass.
You have to take a service elevator to do Hayes at 1 o'clock in the morning.
I've got to go through security. That's what they do. They frisk me and make sure I'm not bringing any like protest posters in or anything like that.
One of these days.
But we do have a clip. I mean, there was nothing. I mean, that hour with Hayes is probably the best coverage they get, in my estimation. Maybe I'm a little biased, probably, but nevertheless, that tends to be the best of it. So again, tough night last night. The full results are not in. We don't know about Washington State. Last check, I don't know, maybe an hour or two ago, it was 32% to Biden, 32% to Sanders, actually 12% to Warren. They have mail-in ballots, and that was, I think, before she had dropped out of the race. 67% in there. Meanwhile, every other race has been called and resolved. Biden won Mississippi, Missouri, Michigan, 53-41. I think that was. And maybe those numbers need to be updated. And Idaho, Bernie Sanders won 14 delegates in North Dakota. or I should say not 14 full delegates. There were 14 delegates up. I mean, he didn't lose all the delegates there. The delegate split as of this morning in the race is 846 to Biden, 684 to Sanders. That's pretty close. You need over 1,900 delegates to get a majority. However, the playing field, at least in terms of the polls, does not favor Bernie Sanders going forward. However, we do know a couple of things. We know that, A, people are voting, not exclusively, but certainly significantly, and we have the most substantial exit polls are from Michigan, but more or less these are consistent with other states, at least on this topic. Would you rather nominate a candidate who, and this is consistent, in fact, this is a little bit lower than we saw in other states, in terms of, but can either beat Donald Trump or agrees with you on major issues? And in Michigan, 58% said beat Donald Trump. 37% of voters said agrees with you on major issues. People did not make up their minds, or there was the people who made up their minds in the last 3 or 4 days ended up going with Biden. I mean, so the determination of who can beat Donald Trump has been, as far as we can tell, and I don't know if there's any like specific polling to this effect, but it would make sense. When you have seven, whatever the major candidates were in the race, and all of them come out and endorse one person, and say, yeah, he is the guy who can beat Donald Trump, your average voter is looking for cues. I mean, maybe they're also just looking for, like, tell me who can beat Trump. You guys are the professionals. Tell me who can beat Trump. And it's very hard, I think, for anybody to counter those endorsements. However, it really gets down to how much can people, how will Joe Biden perform in a debate, a one-on-one debate with Sanders? And that could very well be the first time. I mean, look, people who have stood on that stage with Joe Biden have publicly and privately said, guys lost a step, and maybe sometimes they've said it more aggressively.
Multiple steps.
Right. Reporters who have covered Joe Biden publicly and privately have said the guy's lost a step. Anybody who listens to this show or watches the show probably knows Joe Biden has lost a step. We're putting aside ideology here because for 60% at least of the voters out there, ideology, policy issues, none of that matters. To the extent that it does, those people favored Bernie, 55 to 35. For those of you who agree with on major issues, 53% support Sanders, 39% support Biden. For those of you who feel, 58% of you who feel that can beat Donald Trump is the most important thing, 62% support Biden, 30% support Sanders. So the one opportunity, it seems to me, for this to change, this is something I said after Super Tuesday. There was really only one event that could change the dynamic of the race between Super Tuesday and last night, and that was an endorsement from a major candidate who had been in the race saying, Bernie Sanders, I think he can win. And that would keep the argument alive in some way.
Sorry, self-care comes first. And right. They said, why did I stop the anti-apartheid movement? Why did I lie about my tribal background? First of all, I apologized when I was over 50. And now I need some time to just check in with my own space.
Some people could bring themselves to provide that endorsement. I imagine we will talk about that a little bit more today because, I had some thoughts last night based upon what we heard from Dave Weigel yesterday in terms of what her logic was, Elizabeth Warren's. And the more I thought it through, I think I've sort of figured out like what was fundamentally different. Well, since we're here, we might as well do it. Back in 2016, Elizabeth Warren was able to get concessions, supposedly, from Hillary Clinton in her would-be administration in terms of personnel. All well and good. I'm sure that was for the positive. Of course, that administration never happened. But leaving that aside for a moment, the fundamental difference between 2016, Elizabeth Warren's leverage in 2016 with the nominee versus Elizabeth Warren's leverage in 2020 with the nominee is in 2016, people forget this, Elizabeth Warren was hugely popular in 2014. She didn't want to run. Bernie Sanders did. I think both in Bernie Sanders' mind and broadly in their mind, at least initially, he was just a substitute for her and he was running an issue campaign. I think from Hillary Clinton's perspective, from the Democratic Party's perspective, from the the world at large, when Elizabeth Warren goes to Hillary Clinton and says, you know, you should do X, Y, and Z, her leverage comes from the Venn diagram of her support and Bernie Sanders' support being very similar, almost overlaid at that point. And she could make that argument because she hadn't run. Like, the proposition wasn't tested. There was no data to argue against that. And I think maybe even at that point, it was very similar, those two groups of people. And obviously, when you run an election and each of you get a different number, that suggests that these people aren't the same, right? Because you only get one vote. There's crossover without a doubt. But when Elizabeth Warren made the choice to not endorse Bernie Sanders, as was her choice, she indicated that those people, I mean, maybe in her mind, it was just like Bernie's a bad person. But she also, but to the greater universe, in terms of the way that those people that that voted for Bernie Sanders felt or supported Bernie Sanders felt, like, she's saying she's not with us. That she does not want to marshal our power. And so if she was to go to Joe Biden now, Joe Biden would say, well, you and what army? Because your army is not his army anymore.
Well, yeah. And let's really spell that out. Your army is not his army anymore. And, you know, one of the things that has been mystifying, and I really look, it's no secret, I don't like Elizabeth Warren. I don't like any of these people besides Bernie Sanders. Okay. But table that. We fixated a lot on Pete Buttigieg for, you know, pretty obvious reasons. People like us are going to really not like him. But I don't know what he said in that call with Obama, but that guy absolutely ran a campaign where he ended with way more leverage than he began with. He ran an incredible campaign. It was, I mean, it's ludicrous on his face, and he was, and if I was him, I would be hugely pissed. Like, I have to get out of the way for this guy that can barely function in a debate stage. I'm a 37-year-old mayor who's running second. The reinforcing pattern of Elizabeth Warren and, you know, just totally in contrast to the endless griping and complaining from them is she's a fifth place finisher. Like, not only does she not have Bernie's army, she did not perform, like, she's a distant finisher on her own. So, yeah, she goes to Biden. He'll say, you mean like the people who will almost certainly vote for me anyways? And
right.
And not that many people to begin with. And what else?
Right. I mean, the weird thing is that you see people putting out polls showing that if Warren had, it wouldn't have, her endorsement wouldn't have made a difference. Now, it's quite possible in terms of where her voters would have gone in the abstract, it would have made no difference. But I'm quite convinced that there are voters that were not with Warren, and just the fact that she would endorse Warren would give an indication. I mean, look.
Wasn't that the whole thing that we saw when that happened over the weekend? There were plenty of people saying when we were looking at the silver lining, we're like, you know, actually, a fair amount of these people's second choice is Bernie. But that wasn't the point. The point was the media surge and just the overwhelming fist of this is the safe choice guy, the signal you're talking about.
Right, of course. And the thing is that had she done that, she could have laimed claim to those people. She could have, like, the best opportunity for Elizabeth Warren. I don't know what she wants, but in terms of leverage, particularly in terms of, like, I don't know, VP or any type of position in the administration, would have been to endorse Sanders and then gone to Biden and said, like, I can deliver these people. Where's the proof? Well, the proof is, like, look, I endorsed. And frankly, had she endorsed, maybe it wouldn't have convinced Michael, maybe not Jamie, I don't know, but certainly a huge percentage of those people, there's a significant percentage of Bernie's support that is just fairly normie. They just like they like the idea of debt-free college. They like the idea of Medicare for all.
Oh, 100%.
A lot of those people would have been like, yeah, because I mean, I heard from a ton of those people who are not, don't consider themselves socialists, they're supporters of Bernie, and they're just like, I don't understand what Warren's doing.
I agree with everything you just said. I just think the flip side of that, and that also needs to be brought into the mix, is that she was not a popular candidate in general. And I think, so like, I was actually somebody, yes, I totally don't like her. I didn't think she should have run. Every critique, of course, I have and stand by. If they came up with a deal last week where she was, you know, vice president or whatever, and that satiated her ego, sure, great, let's throw the Hail Mary. But it wouldn't have helped in a general election. I think that we, among other things, including failures in the Sanders campaign, people need to be much more realistic.
It would have helped in a primary.
Definitely. That's why I said I wouldn't have objected to it. It would have been the Hail Mary. It would have been maybe the only thing that could have saved them. But it wouldn't have been more broadly helpful, because outside of a very narrow subset, we're not talking about a popular politician. And I think that's part of what's challenging, is that Bernie does have some real popularity, and there was a lot of obstacle courses put in front of it. Some of his own making and his campaign's making, and also the fact that Cable was a super PAC running against him. And Warren is not popular outside of certain pretty narrow precincts.
But yeah. As much as, you know, I mean, the thing is, as much as it ultimately came down to the endorsements, right? I mean, because that's, I mean, look, Cable was running just as hard against him up to that. In fact, the point where it turned was almost when Cable was like starting to turn themselves. And so, you know, there's no doubt there's a lot of people who did not want Bernie to be the nominee. But at the end of the day, there was people out there who just are like, who's going to beat Trump? I don't know. Somebody tell me. And some voices of authority showed up and they listened to him. I mean, that it's really, you know, for the third of the electorate that made the difference, that's what it was. Everybody else was basically in their corners. And then it was just like these free agents floating around. Who's going to tell me how to vote? And that's what happened. But with that said, that means that the relationship of those voters to Joe Biden, if it's contingent upon the endorsements, it could also be shook by like, wait a second, I just watched this guy for 2 hours, and by minute 65, the dude was like talking gibberish and didn't seem to have any plans. And, you know, I know that all these people have told me this is the guy who's going to beat Trump, but I've watched Trump for 3.5 years and I'm looking at this guy and I'm thinking, no. Now, is that going to happen? I don't know. Is it possible? I don't know if it's likely, but it's possible. And I think, you know, to be fair, I didn't hear the sort of the Republican panels before I got to MSNBC, because like I say, they vacate before I get into the building. But and they could have been all saying, you know, he's got to drop out and this and that. But I didn't get that sense. I mean, when we left here, you know, we were talking last night, like we thought the onslaught was going to be enormous. And I'm not seeing that.
I'm seeing a very funny, you know, move, which frankly should be exploited, which is why I'm not going to spend more time on like who people should vote for in a general if Biden's the nominee. I'm all of a sudden seeing some indications of anxiety about turnout for Biden from these same people. And that's a fear that should be exploited in a Machiavellian way. I also just think I want to go with the paradox that I wish Bernie had run a more normie campaign. I think we have some agreements about that, maybe some disagreements. But I also think that it should really reinforce to people that even a yes, in the real world, in the grand scheme of history, a very moderate and obvious agenda of basic dignity is a class threat. And there is a reason why all of these folks amass together. Because, I mean, not just, you know, forget even Warren. I think Warren is about ego and careerism. But even something like Beto O'Rourke could go from like a silly skateboarding novelty act to like one of the most popular politicians in America with a certain segment of people. But at the end of the day, and he didn't have any immediate, like, the guy is rich. I'm sure he has future plans to run for office, but frankly, that endorsement could potentially go either way. But, you know, these folks really came together because a lot of people really perceived that any sort of even the most modest structural critique of power in our country is a big problem.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I see reasons to be hopeful and reasons to be bummed in terms of the disparity between the exit polls on people's policy preferences and who they voted for. Because what that tells us is people want these things, but they don't believe that they're possible through our electoral system, at least not right now and possibly not ever. Are they just going to give up and say, guess I'll die because I can't afford insulin? No, probably not. I think we're going to see a lot more struggle both within and outside the electoral realm to get the things that we need. Also, I really hope that Bernie is getting his straight razor nice and rusty in preparation for the debate. Leaving it in a rain barrel.
Bring Alzheimer's tests with him.
I got to do some ads, but let me just say this before we go there's two tracks here, right? One is how do you salvage or how do you make the most out of the potential possibility that exists electorally? In other words, like Joe Biden shows up and, you know, starts talking gobbledygook. You know, how do you navigate that in a way that does not inhibit the other track of maximizing your leverage to the extent that there could be any with the party, with the knowledge that they need the left to come along? So there is a balancing act, because you don't want one to inhibit the other, or to the extent that you do, you should be aware of it. But we'll talk about that in a moment, because, you know, time, as you know, ladies and gentlemen, is a limited commodity, particularly if you're like myself, who's constantly running around. You got a whole list of things to do. What am I going to do? This and that. Be careful about that, because water is apparently a commodity around here too. Yeah, you forget. They turned our water off here. But how would you deal with that? Well, if you didn't have much time, maybe you'd check out that book, 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. But if you don't have time for it, how could you do it? Well, an incredible app called Blinkist. It's going to be a new secret weapon for learning new things and getting ahead. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, basically the bullet points from thousands of nonfiction books, condenses them down to 15 minutes that you can either listen to or you can read, and you can do it on your phone, on your pad, tablet, whatever, your computer, web browser. Blinkist is made for busy people who want to get to the main points of a book quickly. They make it easy to finish your book during, I don't know, your walk to the bus, your lunch break. I don't know, just like instead of taking a cigarette break, 15 minutes, 22
take a
minutes.
Knowledge break.
So, well, they range from like 13 things mentally strong people don't do is 22 minutes. But you can get through probably 7 of those in 11 minutes.
The amount of times you're washing your hands now?
Exactly.
Chance to listen to Blinkist.
Exactly. You could listen to one of these like in just like more or less one hand washing. I love it because I've said this before. There's a lot of books out there that I'm like, well, I have two categories of stuff that I read on Blinkist. One is like frankly, that I would be like, I don't want anybody seeing me walking around with this book. You know, like how to win friends or stuff like that, or how to get more emotionally mature. I don't want people to see me doing that.
Books are for nerds.
But I can, well, or no, but there's other books I would like them to see me, but I don't want the how-to stuff. So, and frankly, I don't want to hear a lot of the jibber-jabber. Give me the key points, and I can get it in 13 minutes. But then there's other books where, like, you know, a history book that comes out, or a you know, a culture book, or a society, you know, about a book about, I don't know, like a, they have, you know, like history books. What do you call it? Well, nonfiction, but they're all nonfiction. But like, I don't know, Sapiens, right? It's a big book. People talk about it. I don't know if I want to read the whole thing. I can get it in 19 minutes, or I can listen to it in 19 minutes. So those are the two sets of stuff that I get covered on Blinkist. And with Blinkist, you'll get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all for one low price. For a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Majority Report. Try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist.com/Majority Report to start your free 7-day trial. Saves 25% off. Sign up now at Blinkist.com, BLINKIST.com/Majority Report. Check out, I mean, like, Upheaval is one of those I've gotten the thing that, you know, Jared Diamond book, I would read that, but I don't know if I want to spend the whole time. I'm going to read my 15 minutes and that's it. Boom, I've got it covered.
Just your dose of seeing all of the variables in play.
Right.
Okay, check, 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 check. All right.
Speaking of which, one of the ways I've gotten Saul now to brush his teeth is I got him a kid quip. Because he sees dad's got a quip, and now he's cool like dad, or not cool like dad. Whatever. I've got him hoodwinked for a bit, but he's only 7. The makers of Quip Electric Toothbrush want you to know that the one single discovery that matters the most for your dental care, it's if you have good habits, you're good. And this is what I'm trying to do with my kid. You got to brush for 2 minutes. You got to do it twice a day. You got to floss regularly, no matter what brand you use. And Quip makes that simple, starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric toothbrush has sensitive sonic vibrations. They have a built-in timer, 30 seconds for each quadrant of your mouth. They give you little pulses to tell you time to move on. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with a pre-marked string to help you use just enough. The best part, Quip delivers the fresh brush head, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months. You never have to worry about this. It's a reminder to change your brush head. The brush itself is about the size of a regular brush. It is beautifully styled, frankly. And you use it. You use it when you travel. You use it at home. It's not like those other. It's not one of those things where you got to charge it up and you got to put it on your thing. You worry you get electrocuted. It's super easy, and that's the whole point of it. It keeps you using it, and that's the most important thing when it comes to your teeth. Do the work. And if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's the first refill free at getquip.com/majority. That's spelled GETQUIP.com/majority. Quip, the good habits company. Lastly, Majority Report is made impossible in part by Skillshare. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majority report 6 are going to get a free premium membership to Skillshare for 2 entire months. That's nuts, because you could go through the whole library in 2 months. It's an online learning community that offers thousands of classes on almost any topic you imagine, and all the classes are taught by experts in their field. They have classes on drawing, on painting, on photography. I've done now 2 different iPhone photography classes, and my pictures are better. Video editing, web design, running a small business. I've been working my way through. Spreadsheets. Because I'm trying to do data stuff. I don't know that stuff. Almost all the classes are less than an hour long, and every class is cut up into chapters. So you can do like three chapters and then I got to go do my laundry. I come back, I do three more, whatever it is. It's really convenient. Everyone can benefit from setting aside a little more time to get creative. Skillshare has classes for every skill level. So if you're just starting out on something, you can try something new. If you've been doing something for a long time, you can hone your expertise. Membership to Skillshare is less than $10 a month, and it gives you access to their entire library classes. If you are one of the first 500 people to go to skl.sh/majorityreport6 right now, you will get a free membership for 2 whole months. There's a link underneath this on YouTube. There's a link underneath this. If you're listening to the podcast, check it out. skl.sh/majorityreport6. Number 6. All right. So here are the numbers. I mean, this is where we're at this point. Michael, what is your perspective as to what Bernie should do going forward? I mean, assuming that there is, I don't know what the percentage is, 10% chance, 15% chance, 20% chance, I don't know, 40% chance that he could pull it out. What should he do? What should his disposition be, do? What should he do in the debate?
Well, I mean, he's holding a press conference at 1, so maybe this advice will become irrelevant. But look.
Do you think he's going to drop out at 1? I don't think he will.
I don't think he will either.
Do you think he's going to say, I'm definitively going to the convention?
I don't think he's going to say that either.
I think
he's going to demand a debate. And I think he's going to say that there's some very important states that need to vote and we need to play this out. And I think, you know, I think he can't keep playing halfway. I think that he does need to say tastefully as is possible. But, you know, look, if you're concerned about winning, if you're concerned about how to actually do this in a general, I don't think the guy I'm writing against is exactly up for doing this. I think he does need to convey that. And I think more generally, I don't know how they do this, but I think that they have to have some type of actual demand. And it's very hard because, look, Bernie's going to, if it's Biden, he's going to endorse the Democratic nominee. Bernie is not somebody who wants to risk a second Trump term. And, you know, people should not castigate him for that. But I think, frankly, this is the contradiction I can't reconcile myself. Even as I wish he'd much more talked about the FDR stuff and said, look, if you want normalcy, you need reform, and really tried to kind of synthesize the anxieties that people have with his deeper message. I also think there does need to be a certain, like, he should have been saying every day for the past couple of weeks what he said a couple months ago. Trump will eat this guy's lunch. And if I drop out and if I encourage millions of people, and maybe we didn't hit all of our targets, but we got a hell of a lot of votes and we're the only one resembling a kind of turnout operation. If you want them, it's not about platform. It's not about this and that. I want VP. I want a policy commitment, not for me personally, but I want, you know, I'm not saying it will work, but I think that needs to be more of the mentality, because this game of you go for it, then it's totally blocked out. And then we're just back to like, okay, it's Biden and Kamala.
You know? Here's the problem, right?
There's tons of problems.
No, but I'm just saying in terms of like this whole leverage thing, in terms of like, I want VP or I want whatever it is.
Yeah.
How do you, as Bernie, actually deliver on that threat?
Well, I mean, this is what I'm saying.
Like, if you go to Biden and say like, look, I'll end this tomorrow, but I want X, Y, or Z. And Biden says, sure.
Well, he's going to need Bernie's help.
I think if Bernie's, how does
Bernie not help?
I think if they, well, look, I, this is where oh, I'll be provocative. I think if they spent, I read I forget where I read this, but that in 1996, this is unbelievable to me that the Bill Clinton campaign was afraid of Ralph Nader in 1996 because they thought it could be a point or two in California. That's a time where the left is totally not on the map. It's a campaign that will get max 2% of the national vote, and they're still scared. I'm not saying this will happen, but if I was mapping strategy, I might say, You know, Joe, I think you have basically promised to veto. You've literally said you will veto single payer. You are campaigning against.
He didn't say that. He just said he wouldn't sign it.
Oh, right.
I'm joking.
Excuse me. Excuse me. Exactly. I'm sorry. Apologies to Josh Marshall. So, you know, what I have said the last several months might not be operative. And I might need to look at a third party campaign. I might not be able to promise. And I have to tell you, as much hate as he would get if he did that, the dynamic would certainly change. Because when you go from we're going to box you out in the Democratic primary, that's obviously achievable, to I will use my
platform.
But
does Bernie Sanders want to go down in, like, personally, like, as the guy who had who made it possible for Donald Trump to win?
Well, it'd be a flex.
I don't think
he doesn't want to actually have to do it.
No, I understand, but I'm saying that, like, if I'm Joe Biden, I'm going to look at Bernie Sanders and go, "You're coming at me, and you're going to in any way." I mean, look, you can even say to me, "Joe, I'm going to be so subtle that nobody will know except for you that I'm preventing, that I'm enabling Donald Trump to beat you." And I would look at, and if I'm Joe Biden, and I'm actually conscious of the conversation,
I would say, you're giving Joe Biden a lot of cognitive capacity.
Just assume for a moment, play along. I would just be like, "Bernie, I don't believe you. I don't believe that you've spent your whole life where your final, like, biggest political act will be to make Donald Trump win. Sorry, bud.
I know
you're going to go out and kick ass for me because
yeah. And this is the major,
you care about the people you like.
And this is
dude.
And this is the major problem on the left. Like, if you ask me honestly, look, I would say if it's just dispersed, I'll be really clear. I am not going to spend time like I did in 2016 policing and cajoling people. I'll always say if I was in a swing state, I'd vote against Donald Trump. But I am not. I'm not doing the work of the Democratic Party in this election. I'll be very clear about that.
That's reasonable.
But beyond that, I think that, you know, if outside of silly gesturing, and I know Sanders' answer to this, but I think the paradox is you don't want to be the person that helps Trump get a second term. You also don't want to be the person that basically forecloses on any type of possibility of real actual reform. And I think especially when you add climate to it, we are getting to a point where, you know, the conversations about, like, who staffs the NLRB or whatever, they're important. We shouldn't be children about them. But we're getting to a point where the viability of even playing these games on the margin is starting to become its own form of irrationality.
I agree,
so if I'm Sanders, I would honestly be sitting and looking at, is there an actual play here that at the very, you know what, maybe it just even forces them to call my bluff. And you know what? Fine. So be it. But let's make them sweat. Let's make them scared. Let's make them really work here. And frankly, to me, that's kind of the choice, because this is something that's annoyed me from the beginning of the campaign, beginning with all the unity talk between Sanders and Warren. I think if you go into this election with your baseline being that the only thing that really matters is beating Trump, you shouldn't criticize any of these people. You should be nice to Biden. You should be nice to Bernie. You should be nice to Tulsi, right? But if there's an idea that this is still actually a conflict, particularly one with, like, serious life and death stakes, and I think there is, clearly, you might need to push the throttle a bit and, as I say, at least force them to call your bluff.
Yeah, totally. I don't believe that a Biden presidency would be substantially better than a second Trump term in the long term. Certainly, there would be some short-term benefits to having Biden over Trump. But if you look at his climate plan, he got an F from the Sunrise Movement.
Right. But statistically speaking, the odds are better that Biden's going to actually get to a B or an A as opposed to Donald Trump, who's not even graded because he's off the chart.
Why do you think he's going to get to a B or an A?
Well, I'm just saying that the odds of him getting there are greater, far greater than Trump.
There's no
doubt
about
that.
But
if we also say something like, look, you got to go for Medicare for all because you're talking about 40,000 people a year who die without health insurance.
Yes.
Joe Biden gets in. Let's say he saves 10,000 lives.
I'm not saying that it wouldn't be better on some level.
Well, I mean, it's 10,000 lives. Like, I mean, if Joe Biden gets in, right, and stops, let's say, the court case that is going to roll back the ACA, which could roll back all the Medicaid, which could leave, well, maybe 10,000. It could leave another, I don't know, you know, I don't know how many people have to lose health insurance until you actually see the deaths. I don't know what that algorithm is. But let's say 10,000. Does 10,000 warrant it?
Sure. But then you have to look at what happens at the end of his term when the forces that brought us Trump have only been intensified by these failed neoliberal policies.
Totally agree.
And people's hatred of the center.
But we don't know. By,
we're
going to
get
of
a
Biden,
proper fascist.
Here's what I'm saying.
But at the end of Biden, like, we don't know 4 years out, right?
We don't know anything in terms of, like, although I will say, I think 4 years of Biden could totally lead to 8 years of Josh Hawley. I don't think that's, like, a fantasy scenario. But we don't know.
I don't know that we could get 4 years out of Biden.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it could
three
be,
months
like,
of Joe Biden.
Kamala Harris comes in, yeah, and she just goes, like, surprise, I've been reading a lot more of my dad's writing than you thought, and I've had to, you know,
that's the most optimistic scenario
well, that's what
I've
I'm
heard
saying. Like,
ever.
No, that's not going to happen.
The only centrist that I have a certain personal liking for secretly embraces her father's legacy. I'll live off of that fantasy for a day or two. I guess my point, and it's really genuinely, like, you know, I think that there's some really important work that people can do inside shows like this that are actually important for the left. But my thing is, I just don't. There's one question of Bernie making a big play like that, which I think he should do, because I think things are getting extremely grave one way or another. Okay. And I think we cannot, where I would push back on you is not, like, I think the merits of harm reduction voting are never going to go anywhere. Right. I also think that the idea that it's time to, if you have actual power, I don't think you should be writing a check you can't cash, but if Bernie thinks he has several million people and thinks he can threaten them enough to scare them, I think it's worth a risk, because I think we're in moonshot time right now.
Absolutely.
But more generally, I guess what I'm saying is, at least for me, is I'm not even interested in, look, if somebody tells me I live in Michigan and F them and da 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 da, I'll give it 5 months to say, you know what, I think it's probably worth the off chance that they'll shut down the concentration camps to vote preventatively. I'm happy to say that.
I don't follow that.
I don't
I'm
believe say, that
I'm
Biden
saying,
would
like,
shut
I'm
down
saying
the concentration
that,
camps.
If somebody tells me in a swing state that they're thinking of voting against Biden, I'll take 5 minutes to give them the case you're making.
Okay.
But to me, the preoccupation of where I'm at right now is, what are the actual questions and lessons and things that we need to figure out to make, like, the human project viable? And that sounds incredibly melodramatic, but I think that that's where we're at. I think across climate, I think across a whole slew of policies that were already, you know, this isn't just point scoring. Like, the Obama era was obscene for a lot of people, people who work for a living, people who struggle, people who, you know, what was allowed to happen with Silicon Valley and so on. This isn't just like us having various points on each other on Twitter. It's a critical mass of problems. And I look at Achille Mbembe's piece that he wrote before Trump was elected, "The Age of Humanism is Ending." And that is the predicament we're in. And the fact that Joe Biden is certainly not going to answer that is not just a question of degrees or speed or I want it to happen faster. It is a fundamentally different orientation. And so I'm going to have to ask myself, is it even viable, and what needs to be done to secure some type of democratic future? Not, you know, again, and I just that's why I don't even want to spill a huge amount of hours about how people choose to vote or not, frankly, because to me it's not primary. If somebody, as and I'll reiterate one more time to those people who are getting pissed, if somebody tells me I'm the one swing vote in a key swing state and F them all, I'll say, you know what, Biden might save 5,000 lives. I think that's totally fair point. But I think that argument and that frame, particularly for people who are absolutely immiserated is I certainly can't keep doing it. You know, I had someone very close to me, basically, if we weren't a little bit safer now, like, they would just be homeless right now. Like, they would just be done. And there is nothing structurally that Joe Biden and the leaders of the Democratic Party are going to do for that. And they hold clear contempt for those of us that care about those things. And, you know, I don't take it personally. It's not Warren self-care time, but it is have an analysis time. And yeah. I don't know what the answers are.
Yep. And we also have to remember, you know, most of the people who are going to stay home and not vote aren't going to be doing that because they heard me talking about it on a podcast.
Like, well, I
most
know.
Most of
I mean,
the people look, who don't vote.
I think that argument is like, you can't, we have to operate under the assumption that when we say things on this show, that it's going to have some impact. Because otherwise, then it's not even worth having the conversation.
That's why we're setting
sure,
parameters.
We just have
That's
to.
Sure,
we
but
just,
there's a much larger number
I'm trying to be careful
that we
here.
Need to think about of people who don't vote and don't listen to podcasts. And they are some of the most oppressed people. And a lot of the most oppressed people also can't vote because they're immigrants or because they're incarcerated.
Right.
So that's definitely a limit to the kind of.
But that's different than saying nobody's going to listen to me anyways, so I'm going to say
sure.
this.
I only wanted to say that to like minimize the first thing that I was talking about and make a larger point about the people who don't vote and the people who are the most oppressed in this society. And that's why we can't center electoral politics as our primary thing, because you're leaving a lot of the people out who have the biggest stake in what happens and in the outcome. And I think we also need to remember that the way that we got the New Deal, which was a huge, huge advancement in the material conditions in the lives of working class people, it was also a class compromise. It was a concession given in a larger fight because there was revolutionary struggle in this country. They scared the crap out of the ruling class. It wasn't just, oh, I like that guy's policies, I'm going to vote for him and he's going to do them for me. These were concessions in a larger fight. And even as we invoke the names of popular New Deal policies like the Green New Deal or Medicare, which we've had since 1965, we need to remember the larger piece of the puzzle and how we got those things in the first place. And that is a struggle that can continue and must continue no matter who's president.
But that is actually an argument, though, that you want Biden in office.
Paradox.
Because Herbert Hoover was not going to respond that way. You know, the like FDR was didn't run on that. And he may have been, you know, there was probably like, I don't know if he was there, you know, at contemporaneously, if there was an indication that he was open to something like that more than Joe Biden. I don't think Joe Biden has a terribly like strong ideological strain. I mean, I you
have
know.
Have you read the Branko Marcicicic's book on Yesterday's Man?
No.
I think the other problem with that comparison is I actually do think that the modern Democratic Party is actually profoundly ideologically wedded to this kind of third way politics. And the question that I would have for you, and it's a, I don't know, you know, it's the very simple, like, because this is the dynamic that always happens. I remember when the Progressive Caucus, you know, during the healthcare debate, they had a couple days where like, we're going to hold this up if we don't have a public option. But they could all bank everybody
during
the
Obama
administration. And the Obama could bank.
We have a different Progressive Caucus now than we did then.
Oh, I'm actually even giving them credit, that old lame Progressive Caucus from my perspective. But part of the dynamic, and, you know, I hate how the Obama administration handled healthcare. Fine, of course. But here's part of the dynamic. Joe Lieberman will sink the bill happily because he doesn't give a fuck, excuse my language, if tons of people die. Even your most big hack member of the Progressive Caucus, on maybe not all of them, but I think a chunk of them have the mindfulness of what you're reiterating. could be 2,000 lives, could be 3,000 lives. That matters. And that's progressives, you know, caring about human life is a structural flaw in the exercise of power in a way, you know, and because even if I, you know, the Democratic Party, I think, definitely has more people that are sort of generally on like the left, even if they voted for Biden, if we're going to take those polls seriously as an example. Certainly they do a very small group of affluent people who are like, you know, never Trumpers or whatever. But part of the dynamic, in addition to their own, I think, very genuine and serious ideology, is that, you know, they know that the Joe Liebermans won't vote for Bernie Sanders and they will screw everything over. And folks on the left will, a lot of them will get re-anchored in by just basic humanity arguments, which speaks well of the left. But it's hard for credibly threatening and exercising power. And I think that's a problem, which I absolutely don't know the answer to. I'm just putting in the mix that
right.
It's a problem that Joe Biden probably knows that Bernie Sanders would not do that. I think, frankly, if you had a left that was actually was that, this is the last thing I'll say. What frustrates me is get rid of all the tweets about how we're not going to be normal and all this stuff, like appeal to normies rhetorically across the board. Let go of the posturing woke and socialist and otherwise. That's my view, even as a socialist. And then conversely, actually have some of the like attitude and disposition of like, no, actually, we won't. And deal with that and sit with that. And,
yeah.
You know, that's kind of where I'm looking at
that. That makes a lot of sense. I think we also need to take a page from the French here. When they had a choice between a horrible neoliberal centrist and a crazy racist lady member of the far right, right? The motto was vote for Macron, oppose him from day one. And that's what they've been doing. And he has responded like a fascist and shown his true colors, putting down these uprisings with riot cops. Perhaps he was a little better than Le Pen would have been, maybe not. But I think they did the right thing. And now we're seeing uprisings all over France. We've seen the Yellow Vest movement. We've seen massive labor strikes that incorporate all parts of French society. So, you know, French got advanced capitalism before we did, and maybe they're going to be the first ones to advance to something else. But I think we need to look at our French friends and take notes.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I guess the question is like, you know, how do you, obviously, I think there should be a lot more labor action in this country, just broadly speaking, regardless who's the president. To what extent do you have a, you know, what is the best way to maintain and grow the power that is behind, Bernie Sanders? I mean, he is not going to be there, to lead it for much longer. And it's not clear quite yet who are going to be the sort of the heirs to that movement, or, you know, are going to step up and fill that void. I mean, we can take some guesses, but the point is, how do you maintain that strength, still play out as much of a chance as you have in this election and maintain it? That's the balance. Right now, that is the very real question that, you know, theoretically they're asking in Burlington right now, which is, how much do we go at Joe Biden and at what cost to the movement? Like, you know, you can't say, like, if there's a 35% chance that we can win this, but the only way to get to that 35% is to essentially light our power on fire.
Maybe that's the plausible threat, though. Maybe because, look, yeah, nobody's going to believe that Bernie won't support Joe, but maybe it actually is as simple as, you know, Joe, I'm going to keep running because it's really important and I expect certain things from you. We'll see. And not just platform things, but actual things. But here's the choice. I am willing to risk absolutely eviscerating you the next several weeks. And you can blame me and blah, 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 blah. But we're still running against each other. It's not like you guys haven't eviscerated me. I'll run every ad imaginable. I will, and I'll accept it. MSNBC's upset, whatever. I don't care. Or if we get some things down in writing, we get some actual stuff going on, we can run the next several weeks, but I'll keep calling you my friend, and I'll keep saying you could win. Maybe that's where the plausible threat is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, what, I mean, let's say he says, you know, we're waiting now because we're going to stream from Bernie's site. Now, my sense is that this is not going to be an announcement. He's going to end the campaign basically because there's a donate button right next to the right of it. And that would be uncool in my estimation.
Yeah, man.
So maybe, I mean, maybe we'll carry it for just a minute or two. But, you know, I think what he's going to say is, look, we have a debate coming up. There was 10 one-to-one debates, you know, in 2008, 10 one-to-one debates. I'm just making up a number, but I know there was some in 2016. And we still have more than half the delegates are still out there. I am only down to Biden by less than 200 delegates, which represents less than, you know, about 10% of the number that you need to just win. And I'm staying in. And he's going to say that. Now, he could still say that and drop out tomorrow. I don't think he's going to. I think that at the very least, he's going to stay in for the debate and then for, you know, next Tuesday.
Let me begin by reiterating what I have said from day one of this campaign, and that is that Donald Trump is the most dangerous president in the modern history of our country, and he must be defeated. Tragically, we have a president today who is a pathological liar and who is running a corrupt administration. He clearly does not understand the Constitution of the United States and thinks that he is a president who is above the law. In my view, he is a racist, a sexist, a homophobe, a xenophobe, and a religious bigot. And he must be defeated, and I will do everything in my power to make that happen. Last night, obviously, was not a good night for our campaign from a delegate point of view. We lost in the largest state up for grabs yesterday, the state of Michigan. We lost in Mississippi, Missouri, and Idaho. On the other hand, we won in North Dakota, and we lead the vote count in the state of Washington, the second largest state contested yesterday, with 67% of the votes having been counted. We are a few thousand votes on top. What became even more apparent yesterday is that while we are currently losing the delegate count, approximately 800 delegates for Joe Biden and 660 for us, we are strongly winning in two enormously important areas which will determine the future of our country. Poll after poll, including exit polls, show that a strong majority of the American people support our progressive agenda. The American people are deeply concerned about the grotesque level of income and wealth inequality in this country, and the American people want the wealthy and large profitable corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes. Overwhelming support for that. The American people understand that the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour is a starvation wage. They want to raise the minimum wage in this country to a living wage of at least $15 an hour. And the American people understand that if our kids are going to make it into the middle class of this country, we must make public colleges and universities and trade schools tuition free. The American people understand that we cannot continue a cruel and dysfunctional healthcare system. And it is amazing to me to see that even in conservative states like Mississippi, there is an overwhelming understanding that we are now spending twice as much per capita on health care as do the people of any other country, while 87 million of us remain uninsured or underinsured. And this crisis, this absurd health care system, is becoming more and more obvious to the American people as we face the challenge of the coronavirus pandemic that we are currently experiencing. Imagine facing a pandemic and having 87 million people who are having a difficult time going to a doctor when they need. And the American people know, unlike Donald Trump, that climate change is an existential threat to our country and the planet, and that we need to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And the American people also know that we need fundamental transformation of a broken and racist criminal justice system, as well as a cruel immigration system that keeps millions of people living in fear. But it is not just the ideological debate that our progressive movement is winning. We are winning the generational debate. While Joe Biden continues to do very well with older Americans, especially those people over 65, our campaign continues to win the vast majority of the votes of younger people. And I am talking about people not just in their 20s, but in their 30s and their 40s. The younger generations of this country continue in very strong numbers to support our campaign. Today, I say to the Democratic establishment, in order to win in the future, you need to win the voters who represent the future of our country, and you must speak to the issues of concern to them. You cannot simply be satisfied by winning the votes of people who are older. While our campaign has won the ideological debate, we are losing the debate over electability. I cannot tell you how many people our campaign has spoken to who have said, and I quote, "I like what your campaign stands for. I agree with what your campaign stands for. But I'm going to vote for Joe Biden because I think Joe is the best candidate to defeat Donald Trump." End of quote. We have heard that statement all over this country. Needless to say, I strongly disagree with that assertion. But that is what millions of Democrats and independents today believe. On Sunday, I very much look forward to the debate in Arizona with my friend Joe Biden. And let me be very frank as to the questions that I will be asking Joe. Joe, what are you going to do for the 500,000 people who go bankrupt in our country because of medically related debt? And what are you going to do for the working people of this country and small business people who are paying on average 20% of their incomes for health care? Joe, what are you going to do to end the absurdity of the United States of America being the only major country on earth where health care is not a human right? Are you really going to veto a Medicare for All bill if it is passed in Congress? Joe, how are you going to respond to the scientists who tell us we have 7 or 8 years remaining to transform our energy system before irreparable harm takes place to this planet because of the ravages of climate change? Joe, at a time when most young people need a higher education to make it into the middle class, what are you going to do to make sure that all of our people can go to college or trade school regardless of their income? And what are you going to do about the millions of people who are struggling with outrageous levels of student debt? Joe, at a time when we have more people in jail than communist China, a nation four times our size, what are you going to do to end mass incarceration and a racist criminal justice system? And what are you going to do to end the terror that millions of undocumented people experience right now because of our broken and inhumane immigration system? Joe, what are you going to do about the fact that we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth and are living with the fact that 500,000 people tonight are homeless and 18 million families are spending half of their income to put a roof over their heads? Joe, importantly, what are you going to do to end the absurdity of billionaires buying elections and the three wealthiest people in America owning more wealth than the bottom half of our people? So let me conclude the way I began. Donald Trump must be defeated, and I will do everything in my power to make that happen. On Sunday night, in the first one-on-one debate of this campaign, the American people will have the opportunity to see which candidate is best positioned to accomplish that goal. Thank you all very much.
Well, it doesn't appear you're going to take questions. And I was going to go to the fun half now, but we need to talk about this. I got to say, I thought he walked that line. I thought that was pitch perfect. It was exactly like all the elements that we were talking about what he needs to do. He basically, I mean, it was a brilliant move. Because he's leveraging that stuff in a way that doesn't sound like a threat. He, by saying, these are the questions I'm going to ask at the debate. When he gets to the debate and asks those questions, it doesn't look like he's doing it to beat Joe Biden. He is basically saying, this is my ask right here. You want to beat me in the debate? Here's the key. Here are the keys that basically lock up this election. You can pick up those keys and you can lock up this election, because if you have an answer for these 10 questions, how do you deal with healthcare bankruptcy? How do you deal with providing healthcare as a right? How will you deal with climate change? How will you deal with the issues around free college for option? Criminal justice. What will you do with undocumented immigration? What will you do about childhood poverty? What will you do about money and politics and wealth inequality? If you can tell me, you win, right? Like, that's basically what he's saying. Like, you can write. He just said, here are the keys to the castle. I'm handing them to you, but you've got to take them from my hand. Instead of doing that, like, you know, I mean, it really was the only path you could follow at that point. He is both like leveraging without it making it seem like he's holding anybody hostage. He's just saying, like, here it is, no mystery. You want to beat me? Here's how you beat me. You answer these questions, and if you can answer those questions, then you win. And it's a way of Sanders, you know, walking away with this stuff. Now, of course, it's also a bit of a challenge for Biden, because A, even if he actually had written down answers, like, we don't know that he could deliver them. But I'm saying that I don't know how you could have done what he just did better.
No, he did it absolutely perfectly. And it, of course, does leave the door open with the stats and, you know, the things he emphasized in terms of key parts of the electorate. He's also saying, look, 90%.
That's the threat.
Yeah, that's the threat. And he's also, and I think the other part of the threat, and the 5% or 3% or hell, maybe even 10%, because it will be brutal watching Biden, I think, that this race might come back into play. If a lot of people watch us talking for 2 hours together and they see, first of all, that you have no answers to any of the substance, and then they see the other things that it's impolite to point out, but is very apparent to anybody that isn't being gaslit, you can't gaslight that. That might put back into play a handful of, you know, some people to say, wait a second, who exactly is the electable one here? So yeah. I thought that was, I agree. I think the synthesis that we were all sort of stumbling for between the three of us, I think he basically did.
And He even made it super, super fair for him by giving him this long to prepare with all of the people helping him out. If he still can't do a decent job answering those questions and, you know, staying lucid, then that should tell you something.
All right. With that said, now we're going to go to the fun half. You can join us in the fun half by becoming a member, by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get all sorts of goodies, you get the free show free of commercials. You get extra content every day. I'm just uploading right now, actually. Probably we'll have it up shortly. The video of the primary night coverage we had last night. Virgil Texas called in. We had Bobby Big Wheel in the studio, Aaron Kleinman, and Nomiki had a little bit of like a, she went on like a little bit of a tear. So that was exciting. And nobody got super drunk or anything like that, which, you know, but still, it was fun. It was interesting. And we, you know, a lot of like sort of the predicate of what we talked about, I think we were a little bit more bummed, I feel, than, you know, I think was probably warranted. But, you know, I think we were right on the cusp of Michigan. We didn't know what was happening with Washington State. But also, I think there was, I mean, it's interesting to compare where we were last night, I think, where we are today. But you can check that out. Also, don't forget amquickie.com. You want to get 6 minutes worth of news? Sometimes it's written by Corey Pine. Sometimes it's by Jack Crosby. Lucy Steiner and I switch off voicing it, depending on if I have to be with my kids or not on any given day. Get a sense of like what my schedule is sometimes. check out amquickie.com. And all that's available on the app at majorityapp.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Tonight is a special night of TMBS, isn't it, Michael?
Indeed. Adolph Reed Jr., the god, read him. Will be joining us. Then Liz Franzik, True Anon podcast, will be kind of breaking down all of this and the, you know, the big questions that we make an attempt to explore on the show. I'm sure a ton more Mandela Warren will be appearing. Folks, you can also go to the homepage at majority.fm and get tickets to live shows we got coming up in Austin and Boston. And, someone actually pointed this out to me the other day. When we're live on TMBS, I would watch it on our YouTube channel, but you can actually listen to that on the Majority Report app as well. Patreon.com/TMBS. Get the whole thing. We'll see you tonight at 7 o'clock.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, a wave of wildcat strikes, blockades, and general militant organizing is spreading across the University of California system based on the demand that academic workers be paid a living wage. We are joined by three union members from UC Santa Cruz who were fired for refusing to turn in grades until their demands are met. So with them, we discuss the history of UC strikes, starting with the 2009 occupations that were a precursor to Occupy Wall Street, how the struggle began, the meaning of Bernie's support, their broader political vision, and what lessons the wider working class can draw from it. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
I got a plug, too. My band is playing tomorrow at the Kingsland in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. We're playing with a touring band called Well Wisher. And if, Jamie, you want to throw to this, I have their audio tree session going. And look, these guys are rocking. So
who's that? Wait, is that?
I literally thought this was a new MR song.
Wait, are these you guys?
No, this is the band that we're playing with.
Where are you?
Where's the video of you guys?
Yeah, where are you?
We are content.
Where's
light
Means
right
and
now.
Ways?
We're new. We're getting in the studio next month, so we'll have some stuff.
Who
out
do you want to shoot it? You want me to direct your video?
I want Audio Tree to direct our video. You can do it. Yeah, you want to do that?
You want a little 90s spin on it?
Yeah, I think that would fit perfectly.
Sam will be like, it's like the Cranberries.
We're going to do a lot of like Dutch angles.
Nice. Yeah, some fisheye lenses.
Sorry.
And
you're going to go to the grunge forest?
I'm apologies. I just want to make sure. Have you heard of the Cranberries?
The who?
Okay, all right.
What about the Lemonheads? You probably like the Lemonheads.
Nah, it wasn't a huge.
They're from Boston.
Yeah, I know.
Who did you like?
I was more like
Talking Heads guy.
I guess well, I mean, 80s. I liked the Talking Heads when I was in high school, but like
Jonathan
Richman. Well, Jonathan Richman also when I was in high school, but like at that age, it was like Mudhoney and the Replacements. They were basically done, and love early Nirvana and Yo La Tengo and Uncle Tupelo. I would see a lot, and Buffalo Tom, and
we
you know,
a little
the
bit of the
scene.
Replacements in us.
Sure.
Well, soft boy music. Yeah.
Sure.
All this time, I thought you were lame for not knowing about bands, but it turns out you're too cool to know about Ace of Base.
Yeah. I didn't listen to that garbage.
It.
No.
Wait. When you say that Ace of Base is garbage,
Morphine,
a lot
like
of
Sandman would play around the corner. And Treater Orange, the Blood Oranges, and Treater Wright got together, and they'd do like a super jam session. Folks! Don't forget to check out Literary Hangover, too. Bye-bye. See you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5, 8, 3.9 billion.